The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
I remember going on the east side in Wilmington in one of those old Victorian three-story apartment buildings. Then anything else? You realize that? The point is, we ask so much of you. So much of you.
The first clip there is Joe Biden in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, on Tuesday, August 30th. That was his speech where he was trying to claim that the Democrats were the party of law and order. And you see the crowd size there. You see all of his comments falling flat. The audience has zero energy. I'd say there's maybe, I couldn't find actual numbers on the audience there. Probably 200 to 300 people, I'm being generous. And then the second part of that clip is Donald Trump, also in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, 4 days after Joe Biden on Saturday, September 3rd, in a stadium filled with 11,000 people. And rumors are there are a few thousand more outside of the stadium watching. Now, Pennsylvania is a swing state. Wilkes-Barre, the county that is in, is considered a swing county. And Democrats are still saying that Republicans are losing momentum, that Trump isn't popular. But there's the fake president in that city with a flat crowd, no enthusiasm, no excitement. And then you see Donald Trump, the real president, in that same city, so much energy, so much momentum. I had to turn that clip down because it just was blasting through on the audio. And then the Democrats come to the defense. Well, we don't need crowd sizes like that. That's just a MAGA cult. They're crazy fanatics worshiping their leader. And, you know, we win elections through, the quiet part out loud, deceit and subtlety. Don't forget, they know the momentum. They can read that. Remember how excited they were about Barack Obama in 2008, screaming their heads off. Well, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston, your guest host for today's show. Thank you for joining us on this Labor Day. Mr. Andrew Locher will have the show tomorrow, and then on Wednesday, Mr. Stephen Fleury will be back, returning from his trip to England. Any comments for the show, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Any literature requests, you can do those online. You can also call us toll-free, 1-866-930-3024. You can listen to us live weekdays at 11 a.m. td@thetrumpet.com/live. If you want to watch the show, if you want to listen, you can also listen at our website. You can listen online, td@kpcg.fm. Axios had this to say about Trump's speech, or Biden's speech, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. They say Luzerne County, where Wilkes-Barre is located, featured one of the biggest pro-Trump swings of any major county between 2012 and 2020. Former President Obama carried the county with 52% of the vote in his re-election, but Trump won 57% of the vote there against Biden in 2020. The Cook Political Report with Amy Walter moved Pennsylvania's Senate race to lean Democrat this month, citing widespread GOP concerns with the state of Oz's campaign and a few others. But look at that county there, which they now have turned to lean Democrat. Look at the difference there between the enthusiasm for Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And then it was a couple days after Biden was in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He gave that speech on Tuesday. Then Thursday, he went to Philadelphia to deliver his speech on the soul of the nation. He didn't even explain which side he was on in that battle for the soul of the nation, but I think the optics of that speech would indicate to you which side he's fighting for. There's quite a bit more fallout from that speech as well. Even Democrats were finally coming around to being a bit critical of it, especially his use of the military in the background there. This is from a CNN host, Brianna Keller. Whatever you think of this speech, the military is supposed to be apolitical. Positioning Marines in uniform behind President Biden for a political speech flies in the face of that. It's wrong when Democrats do it. It's wrong when Republicans do it. And the White House spokeswoman, Karine Jean-Pierre, she was asked about this, and she said, well, that wasn't a political speech at all. I was going to play that clip, but it's almost just too easy to pick on her. Joe Biden, it seemed like he forgot that he gave that speech. This was on Friday. He said he was asked about his comments about Trump supporters being a threat to the country, and he replied, I don't consider any Trump supporter to be a threat to the country. I'd play the audio, but it was pretty bad. He was pulling his microphone off and walking away. It's as if he forgot what he said the night before. This is a quote from that speech. Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundation of our republic. And then later on in that speech, but while the threat to American democracy is real, I want to say as clearly as we can, we are not powerless in the face of these threats. And then the next day, I don't consider any Trump supporter to be a threat to the country. Maybe it wasn't. It was already, the fallout was so bad, he already had to backtrack on it, or he just forgot he gave the speech. Maybe in his heart of hearts, he really knows they're not a threat. Well, I wanted to comment on that, just to play that clip showing you the difference in momentum, the difference in enthusiasm and excitement. One of those presidents campaigned from the basement, never came out and met with people. If he did, they were in circles 6 feet apart, and there were about 20 of them. And it looks like that continues to be the way his campaigns and his rallies are held. Not a lot of excitement. He could have easily said, let's open it up. Let's do it in a stadium. You know that they don't want to do that, because what are the optics going to be when they can only fill, you know, a 20th, if they're lucky, of a stadium like that? Well, Bill Barr, he was making the rounds on Friday. He came on Fox News, and he was talking about the raid on Mar-a-Lago. We played a few clips from him a couple weeks ago where, again, it sounded like he was just selling out. He was okay with the two-tiered system. And we've, since the 2020 election steal, we've played the clips of him where he seems a little more squeamish. He's not his normal straight shooter self, where he's 110% confident that these are the rules and this is the way things are going to be. But he's coming on there and he's, you know, against Donald Trump. He's, well, let the FBI do its job. We've got to let this play out. Here's a clip from him on Friday. This is clip two.
I frankly am skeptical of this claim that I declassified everything, you know, because frankly, I think it's highly improbable. And second, if in fact he sort of stood over scores of boxes, not really knowing what was in them, and said, I hereby declassify everything in here, that would be such an abuse show such recklessness that it's almost worse than taking the documents.
To that point, though, there's some...
I just wanted to leave that freeze frame up there, because that face that you see up there, it's almost like he was unsure of what he was saying, and then he kind of like, and just held that there for a few seconds, and he makes gestures like that throughout the interview. Now, this subject, and this is why, and this is what the devil does, makes it so complicated, and then so much is still redacted, and it's behind closed doors. We can't know exactly what's going on, so everyone's left to speculate for themselves. So I don't want to get into that as much. All of these, well, he declassified it, he didn't. What does that make of this? They're purposely doing that because they want to just have the conversation beyond those, well, in the weeds. Now, like I said, there's so much we don't know. There are things the Trump team could have done differently. But for Bill Barr to come out and he's really taking the side of the FBI here. He's really looking at Donald Trump and saying, they messed up, they shouldn't have done this. Now, there's a whole lot behind this story. I think that's just so fascinating, and it's kind of in this standoff here where, well, if they're subpoenaing these documents and Trump hands over these boxes and they contain the classified materials that Donald Trump supposedly took from the White House because he wanted to sell them to our foreign adversaries because he's the supreme evil and he's going to sell out the country. But then when they subpoena the documents, he forgets that they're in there and actually just hands them over to the National Archives. The National Archives gets them and says to the DOJ, oh, there's classified documents in here. We need you to come and look into this. Either the Trump team just didn't think it was that big of a deal, or they really were trying to cooperate there, or they really have some big documents that the FBI wants to get their hands on. Why did the FBI go in after that initial handover? Well, they knew there were more documents. Well, how do they know? Because they're looking for something specific, but they don't want to say what that is. Because if they say what it is, then everyone's going to know, hey, why are they after those documents in particular? Can we see those documents? Did Trump declassify them for the rest of us to see? We know that they had moles in Mar-a-Lago. We know that they had people inside there. But don't be fooled that this is about the FBI just upholding the Presidential Records Act. That's all they're doing. And that seems to be Bill Barr's approach. This is clip three.
Do you think this type of this raid was avoidable? Do you think a second subpoena, for example, could have been issued?
Well, I think whether the raid was reasonable under the circumstances, whether there's in fact a case to be made, and whether or not, as a matter of prudential judgment, that case should be brought, depend on two questions. The character of those top secret documents and secret documents, how sensitive were they? Second, how raw is the evidence of deceit and obstruction? Do they have really good evidence from people who were involved of
deceit? What do you think the answer to that is?
I personally think for them to have taken things to the current point, they probably have pretty good evidence. But that's speculation. And until we see that, it's hard to say.
That's speculation. But how is that his default after what he's been through for the last 6 years to say, I personally think for them to have taken things to the current point, they probably have pretty good evidence that they don't want to tell anybody else about. And, well, that would jeopardize an ongoing investigation. We're allowed to raid the president's home. As Donald Trump said in that rally, they went through Barron Trump's room, a 16-year-old, and just ransacked the room. And they're not, we're just supposed to trust that they have the evidence. They won't say anything about what it is. They won't say what they're looking for. They won't even tell the Trump team what they're looking for. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But for his default to say, after the whole Russiagate thing, fabricating evidence to secure a FISA warrant, that's pretty risky. That's pretty gutsy to go into a court with evidence that you know has been tampered with by your own agents to present that before a judge, and then when you get a warrant to spy on Americans, you get exculpatory evidence proving their innocence, but you don't show that to the judge when you go to get another warrant. They're lying straight to his face. That judge, they're there to rubber stamp it. If he was worried about his credibility, would have read that and said, no, there is no evidence for you to continue this. Based on media reports, based on biased informants, based on Russian sources, you wouldn't get a FISA warrant unless you probably had pretty good evidence, right? And then Bill Barr, they wouldn't raid Mar-a-Lago unless they probably had some pretty good evidence, because that is totally the track record of the FBI. They raided Rudy Giuliani's home, I guess that was about 18 months ago, his home and his offices, still no explanation on why that happened. And he's proven right by the New York Times, by the Washington Post, it was Hunter's laptop. Here is clip four of Bill Barr.
I think the driver on this from the beginning was loads of classified information sitting in Mar-a-Lago. People say this was unprecedented. Well, it's also unprecedented for a president to take all this classified information and put him in a country club, okay? And how long is the government going to try to get that back? You know, they jawbone for a year. They were deceived on the voluntary actions taken. They then went and got a subpoena. They were deceived on that, they feel. And the record, the facts are starting to show that they were being jerked around. And so how long, you know, how long do they wait?
Again, he has some valid points there. But again, for him to take that stance, well, what's even more unprecedented is for the president to take classified documents to his country club. Well, how he obviously would go there during his time in the White House. So he's bringing classified documents there all the time. There's a skiff there for him to review very sensitive documents. There's Secret Service agents all over the place. The FBI was there and said, it's fine, just put another lock on the door. Barack Obama, he got to take his documents to Chicago. And when all this started coming out, boy, the National Archives really had to run to Barack Obama's defense. They published a statement immediately after all of after the raid. NARA moved approximately 30 million pages of unclassified records to a NARA facility, that's National Archives and Records Administration, facility in the Chicago area where they are maintained exclusively by the National Archives. Well, why did they move him to Chicago? Barack Obama wanted him in Chicago. It's the National Archives. Why can't they say, those records belong to us, we're going to keep them where it's convenient for us to watch them? That's Washington, D.C. Why are they in Chicago? Obama wants them in Chicago. Who's looking over them? Secret Service agents, just like in Mar-a-Lago. Why can't Trump take them there? Why does Obama get to do it? So they're running to Obama's defense, and don't think that Obama and his team don't ever get to go in there and be highly selective about what's made available. It's been 6 years. They have 30 million documents in there that they say, we're in the process of digitizing these documents. They're 5% of the way done. You can't apply for what's it called, where you apply to get these documents disclosed, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA. You can't apply for that to see any of these documents. It's all kept secret, even though it's property of the government, which we're supposed to be allowed to see. They moved them to Chicago because Barack Obama wanted them in Chicago. Donald Trump wanted them in Mar-a-Lago. They can stay in Mar-a-Lago. Now, that's assuming a lot of things about this, assuming that he wasn't even supposed to take them. And then one more clip here from Bill Barr, clip 5.
Where do you stand on the former president's request, obviously, for a special master to independently review this case and what happened, obviously, looking back at a very serious raid of a former president, former president's home?
Well, I think the whole idea of a special master is a bit of a red herring. The only documents that have been taken, it seems to me, that there's a legitimate concern about keeping away from the government and insulating the government from would be documents relating to his private lawyer communications, him as an individual and his outside lawyers. If there's stuff like that, fine, identify it. There doesn't appear to be much of it. I'm not sure you need a special master to identify it. But what people are missing is that all the other documents taken, even if they claim to be executive privilege, either belong to the government because they're government records, even if they're classified, even if they're subject to executive privilege, they still belong to the government and go to the archives. And any other documents that were seized, like news clippings and other things that were in the boxes containing the classified information, those were seizable under the warrant because they show the conditions under which the classified information was being held. So I think it's a red herring. I think it would, you know, at this stage, since they've already gone through the documents, I think it's a waste of time.
Now, we're in uncharted territory with all of this. So everyone's analysis, I've follow quite a few lawyers on their blogs, and they're all pretty conservative, and they've each got differing opinions on, well, this could be the way that this works out, or judging by that statute, this would be how it's handled. It's uncharted territory, and it's stunning to me that Bill Barr wouldn't be more on the side of, this is the way the FBI has behaved the past 6 years. I'm highly skeptical of this decision to raid the home of the former president of the United States. The special master is just a neutral party. They go in to review the documents. Hey, you took a bunch of stuff from my house. I don't trust you because you did that. I want a neutral party to come in, review these documents, take out of that pile what you should not be allowed to see. Now, Bill Barr's stance is, well, the FBI reviewed those documents already, so just trust them. They would never do anything wrong. They would never plant evidence to try to entrap you. They would never leak those documents to the press. They reviewed it, so it's a red herring. And I think at this point, if you're the Trump team, you should have asked for that special master immediately. They waited a couple weeks. I'll get to that more in a little bit, how there's this kind of standoff between Trump and the government where each of them doesn't really want to reveal the cards they're holding. But for Bill Barr to just assume the FBI reviewed it, why do you need anyone else to review it? How come he's not more skeptical of the DOJ? He came in, Bill Barr in 2019 was amazing to read his stuff. He said, we've got to end the two-tiered system of justice. To his credit, he didn't want to go after the political enemies. But at the same time, he also didn't prosecute a lot of crimes that were committed by political enemies that were overt crimes. Let's go on a trip through memory lane here. I've got a list of things that Bill Barr or Donald Trump's DOJ under Jeff Sessions and, remember, Rod Rosenstein declined to prosecute. There was the spying on the Trump campaign, the illegal warrants, and all that happens is one lawyer gets a slap on the wrist, he loses, he can't practice law for a year, and he's back. NBC headline, government drops charges against all inauguration protesters. Remember January 20th, 2017, where they were firebombing cars in Washington, D.C., where they were fighting with police, hitting them, throwing bricks at them? They arrested 190 people. If that was January 6th, you can bet those people would still be in jail right now. Instead, Trump's DOJ dropped the charges. James Comey, Peter Strzok, Andy McCabe all get off the hook. James Comey, if we want to talk about classified information, remember his meetings with Donald Trump where it was the defensive briefing, but it was really an interrogation, and Trump doesn't have his lawyers there. James Comey takes those notes, which are privileged documents, property of the government. He only gets that interview because he is the director of the FBI. Doesn't tell anybody he has those notes, puts them in a safe in his basement. Then he gets fired. He has those notes, doesn't turn them back over to the government, keeps them in his safe. Then he wants to trigger a special counsel, takes those notes, hands them to his friend, says, hey, read these, then tells that reporter at the New York Times, I want them to know about my concerns. Then the FBI comes in after they find out about this, gets a hold of those documents and decides, none of them were, there was no classified information. It wasn't confidential. James Comey is just fine. Bill Barr's DOJ, we won't prosecute him. Andrew McCabe, same thing. Leaks to the Washington Post. They have it there. Bill Barr says, I don't want to get too political. I don't want to get nitpicky. We're going to drop that case. Kevin Kleinsmith tampers with evidence, penalized for a year, gets off the hook. 2020, insurrection, all of these riots. This was someone making that point. Hundreds of videos. This was just in Washington, D.C. on one weekend in May. 60-plus Secret Service agents wounded, 11 hospitalized. No pretrial detentions for 18 months or prison sentences of 5 to 10 years by the Bill Barr Department of Justice. That was just in Washington, D.C. You've got the COVID outbreak in Wuhan. Evidence that the United States, Fauci's department is funding it. DOJ, quiet. Eric Swalwell, compromised by a Chinese spy. Remember Fang Fang? Nothing there. You've got the Hunter Biden cover-up, all happening while Bill Barr is over the DOJ. And we learned last week that, remember Tony Bobulinski, Hunter Biden's the business partner who was just there to set up the corporate or the legal structure? He's spilling the beans on Tucker Carlson, and Tucker says, well, you gave this to the FBI. How come they haven't done anything? You know who his handling agent was when Bobulinski brought all of that stuff to the FBI? His handling agent was Timothy Tebalt, the guy who has just resigned, was responsible for burying the Hunter Biden story. And now we know why Bobulinski's evidence didn't go anywhere, because Tim Tebalt just buried it. That was Bill Barr's DOJ. There's the attempted assassination of the governor of Michigan, where the FBI set up deadbeats to kidnap, armed them, trained them, funded them, gave them transportation. That was Bill Barr. That was his DOJ. That was the FBI that he ultimately oversaw. The 2020 presidential election, Bill Barr won't touch it. He was fiery in May and June about those mail-in ballots. And then afterwards, well, I called the district attorney in Michigan, and he said, it's just, they always have vans bring ballots in the middle of the night. So that was that. The Rudy Giuliani raids in 2020. The January 6th involvement, the FBI, we're getting red flags ahead of time. We're not going to tell Capitol Police. We'll put our informants in there. That, again, Bill Barr, I think, had resigned by that point. Then you've got Democrat attorney generals in New York and Manhattan investigating Donald Trump nonstop. And Bill Barr's default is to say, you know, the FBI has probably got a lot of evidence, or they wouldn't have done this. They really would not. There's just not the United States Department of Justice. They would not raid a former president's office if they didn't have evidence. Clearly, two standards of justice. This is a quote from America Under Attack. Mr. Fleury writes, "In America, innocent until proven guilty is a foundational principle of justice. The burden of proof is on the accuser. If someone accused you of colluding with Russia, you wouldn't have to prove you didn't. The accuser would have to prove that you did. Yet the Justice Department and the government tried to make Donald Trump out to be guilty unless he proved his innocence in a blatant attempt to dethrone him. This is what the 2 Kings 14 prophecy is all about. There was no helper for Israel. Do you see any help?" Mr. Fleury says, "There is nobody, especially in Washington, who is a helper for Israel. God was using Donald Trump, but leftists stole the election, and he has been politically exiled. And none of these terribly guilty elites are being prosecuted, much less convicted or imprisoned, because even many of the prosecutors and the judges are corrupt. We know that the Justice Department and FBI lied to the FISA court, yet that court never said anything about it. Why is that? Because they are in on it. This shows you the power of the radical left deep state, and the deep state now that Bill Barr is rushing to defend." I want to talk about a few more details with the Mar-a-Lago raid, just to explain some things in the news. You're hearing a lot now about the obstruction charge. They create the fake crime, then they investigate, and they say, hey, you're obstructing our investigation. And that's where they get you, is on this process crime. So the DOJ files this 36-page filing the other day, arguing why Donald Trump doesn't need a special master. And in there, they lay out their case for why the Trump administration obstructed them. So they issued a subpoena, and the subpoena was incredibly broad, and it asked for Donald Trump's lawyers to turn over any and all documents bearing classification markings. Now, Trump's lawyers should have just said, look, that is not specific at all. I mean, anything bearing classification markings. I can download stuff. Anybody can download stuff from the government that bears classification markings. Doesn't mean you're not allowed to hold on to it. Is that something that you turn over? So Trump's lawyers should have said, that's not specific. I guess we'll just give you what we can here. So it's a pretty broad request. But then Trump's lawyers, they hand over those 15 boxes, and they sign a statement that says, we've handed over everything that the subpoena requires, and we've did a search, and this is all of it, and to the best of my knowledge. That's the key phrase there. So then the FBI comes in the raid. They say, hey, there's documents bearing classification markings. You said you handed all of that over. You clearly are obstructing justice. So that is where this argument is coming from. Now, I think there are plenty of avenues to argue your way out of that, including the lawyer signing that saying, well, I'm signing it to the best of my knowledge. I don't think she is actually the one that went and searched it. Maybe the one that went and searched it was actually the mole that was working for the Garland DOJ. Now, I would think if you were Trump's lawyers, you should have stonewalled even more, not cooperated at all, until they laid out exactly what they were looking for. They did not do this because they wanted to go and get the love letters from Kim Jong-un about those were the nuclear documents, by the way. And they didn't go in there because they wanted the letter that Barack Obama left for Donald Trump after the inauguration. So Trump, he's trying to appoint a special master. He wants to make sure that the FBI will, let's make sure they didn't plant any evidence there. And it looks like he might get it. This judge, it's actually a judge he appointed, seems sympathetic to getting the special master. And I would too, based on the way the DOJ is leaking stuff to the press. And Garland getting up there and say, well, we speak through our court filings. And then you find out things first from the New York Times and the Washington Post. I have the court listener website open, and you hear about all of those documents before they're published on that website from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, this lawyer, this was from a CBS reporter who was in the room as that judge was making her decision, and she thought, well, this is a really overbroad application of some of the cases that you're citing. And then she asked the DOJ lawyer, the FBI counsel, Jay Bratt, about the materials that were seized. And he had to note that, well, he didn't clearly state that they were classified. All he said was they were marked that way. Now, that's pretty interesting because a lot of the folders that were confiscated, we now know, were just that. They were folders that said classified, but then didn't have any documents in them. Politico writes that Garland has a perilous path to prosecuting Trump because of how they have to present this evidence to a grand jury. Well, it's so super top secret, we can't actually present it to you. You can't actually see it. You just have to trust us. Now, the latest rumor is that the DOJ, they're not going to make any decisions until after the midterm elections. It's a standoff right now, and I suspect they want to slow walk this as much as they can because they overplayed too fast. And they seem to be behaving a bit desperately. There was the big picture that all last week, the picture of the documents in Donald Trump's office, as if he just keeps them on the floor open. There are quite a few interesting tidbits about that image. And one of them was that in that picture you see these cover sheets, they're called. And on the cover sheet it says SCI documents. And then we hear afterwards that most of these so-called classified or secret documents were actually empty folders. So there are 48 empty folders with classified banners. And then the DOJ took a bunch of clothes. They took books. Now, on August 11th, they released that first inventory list. It was the list of, here's what we took. And it says, we took boxes. And in those boxes, there was confidential material. There was classified material. There was secret. There was top secret, and there is something called SCI, which is sensitive compartmented information, which can only be viewed in an ultra-secure location. But then they published this picture showing that, well, they're opening these documents in Mar-a-Lago, which they argue is not a secure location. So why is the FBI, on top of that, taking pictures of these documents? Did they have a security clearance to do that? Did they make sure their iPhone or whatever wasn't being hacked and that those top secret documents weren't being leaked? Then on August 30th, they release a more detailed inventory list. And then in that more detailed inventory list, they don't say that there are any documents bearing the classification marking SCI. But then in the picture they published the next day, you see a bunch of documents that bear the marking SCI. Well, what's going on there? They collected 88 empty folders total that had some sort of classification marking. So did they literally just confiscate empty folders in that raid and all of the classified documents were actually handed over? It's pretty interesting. There are a lot of different scenarios, and it's a standoff at this point, because if Merrick Garland wants to go in there and get those documents that he's after, he has to spell out what documents he's after. And maybe Donald Trump really did just empty the folder and say, I'm holding on to these. But the fun part now is, well, Garland doesn't know where they are. So where do you get a search warrant next to go after those documents? And if you do get a search warrant, you have to spell out what it is you're looking for. And I don't think they want to do that. Lee Smith at Tablet wrote an article titled, Why Did the FBI Raid Mar-a-Lago? And he connects it back to Russiagate. It's the same people. And one commentator was noting how there's a lot of details about this case that make it seem like the DOJ is not ready to prosecute this. They're not handling it from the FBI office down in Miami. They don't even have a prosecutor appointed yet. It's all being handled by a team in Washington, D.C. that handles sensitive material. So it's almost like the goal was really to just retrieve these documents, and we don't want it to go to court. Because if it goes to court, there's discovery. You've got to present the evidence of why you did it to that grand jury. And it seems like they don't want to do that. And then Donald Trump, that subpoena says hand over the classified information. He declassified it, but it didn't go through the review process. That's what Lee Smith writes about right here. He says, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows agreed to submit the documents for a final review. This is the crossfire documents that Trump said he would declassify at the end of his administration. I am returning the bulk of the binder of declassified documents to the Department of Justice, Meadows wrote in a memo, with the instruction that the department must expeditiously conduct a Privacy Act review under the standards that the Department of Justice would normally apply, redact material appropriately, and release the remaining material with redactions applied. Now, that didn't happen. They stonewalled, but Donald Trump did declassify the documents as that memo lays out, but it didn't go through the formal process there. So for Donald Trump, those documents are declassified. He's the president. He can do it however he wants. But he doesn't want to publish them because, well, it's not redacted the way that it should be. It doesn't have the classified marking crossed out like it would for a document that we would download. But he's the president. He has the liberty to do that. Then you look at the DOJ that's supposed to review it, and it's all filled with Obama cronies. Lee Smith writes, yet if what the FBI was after were the Russiagate documents that it imagined were hidden somewhere at Mar-a-Lago, it's not clear if the agents found them. According to the Times story, the safe in Trump's closet did not contain the materials investigators sought. Maybe the materials were somewhere else. Perhaps Trump never had them. Trump allies I've spoken with don't think he has the documents. Smith writes, the effect of the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago is therefore to obscure the real scandal. U.S. spies committed a series of crimes in their effort to unseat a U.S. president and then ignored the lawful orders of that president in order to keep their crimes hidden from the American public. What is preserving the stability of the United States at present is therefore something like a Mexican standoff. Who is going to budge? Where are those documents? What are the documents? Does Garland really want to prosecute this, or was it all just a ploy meant for the midterms? And going back to that double standard of justice that, you know, Bill Barr just ignores. Carter Page, we talked about in that FISA, that's the man that they tried to surveil so that they could get their open door into the Trump campaign. He's been trying to sue the government for years because they turned his life upside down based on lies. And just recently, a federal judge just tossed out that lawsuit. It said you don't have any standing to sue the government in this way. Miranda Devine wrote, judge throws out Carter Page lawsuit against the FBI for illegally spying on him. The judge says Congress does not permit such lawsuits against federal agencies, and James Comey and others named as defendants did not personally perform the surveillance of him. In other words, the accountability is impossible. Well, Carter Page doesn't know the low-level employee that was actually the one spying on him, so he doesn't have grounds to file a lawsuit to get any sort of recourse for the damages that he's experienced over the past 7 years. You can't hold them accountable. Bill Barr's DOJ. The answer to Barack Obama only. I mentioned about that FBI agent, the handling agent for Tony Bobulinski, covering up that Hunter Biden evidence. There was another January 6th protester sentenced to 10 years in jail. That was on Friday. He wrestled with a police officer. The document doesn't say anything about how the police were provoking the crowd that day. Now, obviously, you shouldn't wrestle with a police officer, but 10 years for that. And you think about the videos that you see on a daily basis in New York City, in Los Angeles, in Portland, of people resisting arrest. And those attorney generals, those prosecutors, just let them right out the next day. No bail. And maybe 10 years, that's appropriate for what that man did, wrestling with the police like that. But then you compare it to how none of most of the 2020 insurrectionists were not held accountable. The thugs that burned down police stations. My favorite of all of them is these lawyers in New York City that firebombed police cars, potentially killing police officers. Now, for that, that's pretty much attempted murder at that point. And that would bear a minimum 10-year sentence for something like that. You know what Bill Barr's DOJ, you know what the prosecutors in that case decided? Well, we're going to go for 18 to 24 months. Don't forget all of those visuals of people attacking police much more aggressively, I'd say in some case, than on January 6th in Chicago. They brought frozen water bottles. They brought PVC pipes with pointed ends, and they were trying to stab their way through the police lines. Totally organized. And then you've got Chris Ray that just says, Antifa is an ideology. We can't monitor an ideology. Kamala Harris, she bailed out another one. This one's a really doozy. Bailed him out. This was part of the fund that, you know, she's telling everyone donate to bail these people out. That man gets freed. He goes on to shoot and kill a passenger on an Amtrak train. Those are the people that your leaders want on the streets, who come to the defense of the criminals. Really amazing what's happening in the United States right now. To see America under attack and to see so many people that still do side with those leaders who are coming to the defense of radical criminals. Well, we'll go ahead and take a break. In the second half, we'll talk about a little news from Europe. If you have any comments for the show, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily.
It's these policies that are ESG driven and morally driven, that we should convert everything to alternative energy tomorrow, are going to end up starving the poor children of the world, like it's and killing many of them. So it's counterintuitive that that could actually happen, and that's what we're seeing, Melissa, with the prices at $1,000 a megawatt hour, 1,000 euros a megawatt hour. You know, you're going to see real problems in Europe. I can't believe it's not on the front page of every paper every day.
That's on CNBC, a man warning. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance, and it's the score that's awarded to businesses who comply with the green agenda. So they're just given this meaningless number, and oh, they all want that score because they want the optics of looking good. And he's saying, look, these things are going to kill people because you're forcing a transition that the market is not ready to do. And then he talks about the price of electricity in Europe. I can't believe it's not on the front page of every paper every day. I see a lot of posts from just people or businesses in Europe, Spain and Italy and the UK talking about their estimates for next year. They signed that contract for their business, locking in their electricity rates, and they're just dumbfounded. This was just posted. It says, my current energy bill for my tiny 22-cover restaurant, I'm assuming that just means 22 seats or something, is $2,928 a year. This is my new quote, and it was for 22,000 pounds. So almost 10 times higher. They write, unsure what to actually do next, but as a business, that cost would now be more than I pay in rent and more than I take in some months. I simply don't have the money for this. So if lockdowns didn't kill these businesses, the rising electricity costs are going to come in for the final knockout blow. Another one posted their bill. They said last year it was 21,000 pounds. This year I'm forecast to pay 91,000. Just all sorts of little examples. One man, just a resident, said I paid 70 pounds a month. Now my bill is 392 pounds. Then you've got all of these economic issues all converging. The euro is, I think the last time I looked at it, it's at parity or might be just below the US dollar. The pound is quickly losing its value. You've got blackouts in Italy. Russia announced last Friday that Nord Stream 1 shut off. They say that there's a leak. We're not going to be sending any more gas through to Europe. So you've got, at the same time, you've got this war in Ukraine that is sending energy costs right up the charts, just a straight perpendicular line up. This winter is going to be bad for Europe. And then at the same time, you've got businesses and governments forcing the ESG policy on people. California is a good example there. They're buy the electric cars, but don't charge anything right now. Our power grid is struggling to keep up. So you're just stuck. And it gives them a lot of control. There was that story out of Colorado where customers who installed these smart thermostats were not able to adjust the temperature in their house. It locked them out. Said, it's going to be set at this, and this is where it's going to be. You can't change it. And the reason that they have the legal ability to do that is because those customers agreed to it because they got a $100 gift card if they agreed to have this smart meter cap put on things. So in exchange for that tremendous amount of control, they're given a $100 gift card, and you read perks like that all the time. Sign up for this, or let us track you in this app, and we'll give you a refund or a discount on this. The control or the influence that people are giving up in exchange for just petty little things is stunning. You see all of these crises converging. Reuters wrote about a protest in Prague over the weekend in the Czech Republic. It says an estimated 70,000 people protested in Prague against the Czech government on Saturday, calling on the ruling coalition to do more to control soaring energy prices and voicing opposition to the EU and NATO. Now, it's amazing, really. I think that this story, like that commentator said, it obviously in Europe, it's probably, or I would think, is going to be one of the top news stories, one of the top concerns, but the United States isn't paying that close attention to it. And I think it's interesting that Donald Trump really called Germany out about this in 2018 and said, why are you going to Russia for oil? Why don't you come to us? And then now they're in the midst of this crisis And you'd think, well, Europe, you know, they were so happy Joe Biden is in office. They're best friends. And I would think, well, how come they're not just on their knees begging for the United States to pump more oil, to drill for more oil, export it now? We need it. We need something. I don't think Joe Biden would do it because he has to save the environment, as if that's the really pressing issue, as people are potentially about to freeze to death, starve to death. Some of these articles written at the Trumpet, written by the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, are so incredible. The foresight that Bible prophecy gives you. In 2018, Mr. Fleury wrote, Germany and Russia's secret war against America. I think that article provides tremendous context to everything that you're seeing right now. It says Nord Stream 2 binds Russia and Germany together in a way that undermines NATO. In fact, though Russia and Germany will not say so, this pipeline project is clearly intended to wreck NATO. Now, it's easy to look at Germany right now and think, oh, well, they're just a cog in the machine, and they're just having to flow with those events. Well, they didn't have control over Russia invading Ukraine. Nord Stream 2 really helped trigger that invasion. And you don't assume that they're just sitting on the sidelines letting these events happen to them. This is a continent, like Mr. Palmer wrote a few years ago, that's forged in crisis. And many ways, Germany likes to be behind the scenes, those elites in business, engineering these crises so they can get more power. Mr. Fleury writes more about how NATO is an obstacle for Germany attaining its goal. It says Germany's antipathy toward NATO is also clear in the fact that the country only spends about half of what they should to contribute to that. It says Bible prophecies about the next resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire show that Germany will soon be spending substantially more on its military and not within any kind of U.S.-led framework. And we've seen that happen after Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Using that as an excuse to boost, I can't remember if they doubled or tripled their military spending, buying dozens of U.S.-made F-35 planes. Mr. Fleury writes, President Trump said Germany will end up being totally controlled by Russia as a result of this gas pipeline deal, and Germany is taking a risk with a dangerous dictator. But this deal will boost more than just Russia's power and leverage. It will also boost Germany's. Germany has much to gain from this, and it will happen in a way that hurts many other nations. History shows that Germany and Russia are not actually partners. When they enter into peace deals and economic partnerships, it is a signal that either or both are preparing for some kind of imperialistic exploit. And those many Germans are going to be struggling this winter. And how many, there are blackouts in Italy, the same in Spain. How are these nations going to respond? Who's going to rescue them? Who's going to set up that structure to help these nations? Mr. Palmer wrote in the May-June 2015 Trumpet an article titled Forged in Crisis. Talks about how these crises, and some of them like the Euro crisis, are engineered to make Germany stronger, to make those poorer nations subservient. But then he says, well, how do they actually unite when they don't have a lot in common, maybe just geographically or politically? And it's the Holy Roman Empire. It's that religious aspect that helps bind them together. Here is a clip from Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. This is in the 1980s, clip number 7.
Gradually, and now faster and faster, a new power is being developed from underneath the surface, a new world power, which the public now least suspects, which the world does not yet see, doesn't realize, doesn't dream is coming, but it is developing just as prophesied in Europe, a resurrected Roman Empire that will combine some 350 millions of population, a power so mighty that our Western peoples will stand aghast when it flashes suddenly into full being. Yes, your Bible says that the world will be startled.
Mr. Armstrong said that it will come out of nowhere. We're going to be startled by it. We don't see it coming. Germany looks like it's going to have a very dark winter, and it probably will be, but don't assume that that just means that's the way it's going to remain. I'd encourage you to go back, read that article from Mr. Fleury about Russia and Germany from the trumpet of 2018. I think it was the May-June 2018 trumpet. And all of the articles he's been writing about the Ukraine crisis, all of it, this foresight, it's prophesying these events before they occur. If you have any literature requests from today's show, call us toll-free, 1-866-930-3024. If you have any comments for the show, you can send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Andrew Locher will be with you on the show tomorrow. Mr. Fleury will be back on Wednesday. Have a great Labor Day.